My mother grew up in a Yiddish-speaking family, and she spoke Yiddish well enough to bargain for tchotchkes in post-war Paris and Florence. But for me, her Yiddish vocabulary consisted largely of judgments and endearments. It was a vocabulary for a large mammal nudging her cubs, a moral, a motivational vocabulary. Lovingly, she called me Ketzela, little pussycat, Tzatzkala, little toy, Herzela, little heart, Schatzela, little treasure, Siskite, sweetness. With a little humor and distance, but still with affection, she called me Schmendrick, little rascal. Her vocabulary was rich with ways for telling me to get lost, which somehow never made me feel any less loved. The most vulgar, but the one she used most often, was gay cock and off and yam, literally, go shit in the ocean. But closer to our go jump in the lake or give me a break, and in my mother's mouth, no stronger. An even milder version was gay bach bagels, go bake bagels. I was always being asked to stop hocking her chinik. Chinik means teapot, as in chai for tea, and to hock it was to bang on it. So someone hocking a chinik was banging on a teapot or bothering someone else. I didn't know that chinik meant teapot. I only knew my mother said, stop hocking my chinik, or occasionally, stop hocking me a chinik, when she was sick of me. I found the word chinik very ugly. And I think I confused my mother's chinik with her vagina. We got no translations. We figured the Yiddish out from context. I understood that my mother wanted me to quit bothering her, although sometimes I thought she meant that I was a pain in her vagina, and sometimes I thought that she meant I was spewing a stream of nonsense as large as all China. And later, when I learned that hock meant to pawn, that I was vexing her by somehow, metaphorically, pawning her dinner service. Whatever it was, I got the point. Stop it. Shape up. Just as the Eskimos are said to have many words for snow, Yiddish speakers had many words for losers. Shlumiel, Schnuck, Schmo, Schmagegi, Schlug, Pisher, Nebish, Putz are just a few of my mother's many ways to dismiss or disapprove of someone. He could be a schnorrer, a ganef, a fresser, a chaser, a starker, a fegele. There are some Yiddish mavens who distinguish between shlemiel and shlemazel, the former being a klutz, and the latter chronically luckless, as in the shlemiel spills soup on the shlemazel. Shlemazel, however, was not in my mother's vocabulary. Luck played no part in character. It was your fault if you were shlemiel, nebish, schnuck, or shmagegi. Yet, these same words could be turned around and used as terms of affection. Schmendrick, rascal, was, as I have said, a loving term she used for me, as well as schnuckle or schnucklepussy, little dope, little pussycat dope. The essence of Yiddish is irony, meaning one thing while saying another, as I am hardly the first to point out, but as miraculously I understood quite early on. Nebish was the queen of words, and like the queen on a chessboard, was capable of moving in many directions. A person could be rejected as a nebish, as in, don't waste your time with that nebish. That's the simple declarative nebish. But nebish was just as often used ironically to mean poor thing. Example, I was picked last in gym class, Mom. Nebish. Is this the worst of your problems? Is this the tough world you live in? I wasn't invited to Miriam's party, Mom. Nebish. I only got a B on the math test, Mom. Nebish. Amplified occasionally as poor little fly on the wall. Somehow, despite this undermining of my self-esteem, I managed to grow up. She wanted each of her children to mature into a Mitch, a human being, a caring, loving, responsible person. To be a Mitch was the pinnacle of her moral code, and it didn't matter that it meant man. Women could be Mitches too, although she sometimes used the English word lady for the moral perfection she thought that my sister and I should aspire to. Be a Mitch meant live up to your responsibilities, accept the inevitable, write thank you notes, make the best of things, strive, seek, find, and do not yield. It was Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, and Christianity rolled into three words. My mother's values were the values of reason, the wise mind, a Yiddish kopf, a Jewish head, or way of looking at things, although this was a phrase I never heard her use. Yiddish kopf was a lost positive, like the combobulated of discombobulated. One was never praised for having a Yiddish kopf, although many were scorned for having a goyish one. Mother taught by negative examples. A goyish kopf cared about the trappings of the store rather than the thing bought, and so would pay full price at Bergdorf when the same dress could be purchased for half as much on the Lower East Side. A goyish kopf spent lots on liquor for a party, but not enough for food. Goyish kopfs had dogs and sent their daughters for baton twirling lessons. Goyish kopfs, it began to seem to us, had all the fun while we were being taught to be sensible. My mother's Yiddish was the Yiddish of American Jews at a particular historic moment when the experiences of immigration and assimilation to a new culture were not far in the past. A klug to Columbus, or a curse on Columbus, or damn Columbus, expressed the immigrant's exasperation with the land of opportunity. Mother said this when her children were being too American, as in, I have to have a new dress for graduation, Mom. A new dress? What's wrong with the old dresses? Everyone is getting a new dress, Mom. A klug to Columbus. How many times must my grandmother have said to my mother, her own only American-born child, a klug to Columbus, and wished she had not had to leave Minsk. When Philip Roth published Goodbye, Columbus, it sounded familiar, and I suspected that he, too, had heard his mother curse the explorer, making his novel's title, which ostensibly refers to a University of Ohio drinking song, makes it a punning rebuke of our whole brave new world. Remember, the protagonist's name is Neil Klugman. Yiddish is a dialect of Middle High German, and the irony of ironies is that the language that united Jews is so close to the language of Hitler. A college department teaching both Yiddish and German, while philologically on a sound basis, might be called the Department of Semitic and Anti-Semitic Studies. Many German verbs begin with the prefix ver, V-E-R, which has different meanings but is most often intensifying, so that loosely speaking, ver equals very. Hungern is to be hungry. Verhungern is to starve to death. Salzen is to salt. Verzalzen is to oversalt. My mother had a whole repertoire of words beginning with ver, like the German ver, and most of them were used to denote a very bad situation. Verblunget was lost, as when in the middle of knitting a scarf, she would drop a few stitches and say, I've gotten all verblunget. Or as, when I changed my mind about going to medical school, she said, You don't know what you want. You're all for blunging. There was for stunkena, something that stinks. For cockta, screwed up, ridiculous, literally very shitty. And for schlugana, pathetic. There was for schwitzt, for mischt, and for schlept. Very sweaty, schwitzy, very mixed up, mischt, very much a burden, schlept. There were many ways to be confused. For dreht, verged on congenitally ditzy. While for tutzt, too upset to think straight, was said of someone who was usually sensible, like oneself. I loved the fur words with their passion and exasperation. What a verschlugene idea, or what a verstunkene movie. What a verkackte excuse. We have to go out to a verkackte dinner party, or write that verkackte thank you note already. Currently, my favorite fur word is verschleppte, as in, spare me that whole verschleppte crank, or enough with that verschleppte crank already. Crank is sickness. Verschleppte means long, drawn out, or chronic. So verschleppte crank means a long, drawn out disease, metaphorically, whatever my mother was fed up with hearing about. Still talking about getting a job. What if I schlepped a crank? Enough is enough. Genug is genug. Still reading War and Peace. For schlepped a crank, why don't you read something you can finish? My mother devoured novels, but was hard on them. They were schmaltzy, literally fatty, but meaning sentimental. She had many expressions for sentimental trash, because that's the kind of book she liked to read, before casting it aside as too sentimental, just a Bubba Misa. I misheard that as Bubble Misa, with bubble meaning bubble, and Misa meaning to me masterwork, and invented the definition soap opera, when the actual meaning was an old wives' tale. The ways I invented for her Yiddish to make sense sometimes led me astray, but not far. For instance, whenever my mother referred to someone who had died, she said, Oliver Shalom, as in, your grandfather, Oliver Shalom, would have loved to be here to see you go off to kindergarten. At first, this expression was bewildering to me because I knew my grandfather's name was not Oliver Shalom, but Meyer Davidoff. Slowly, I deduced the notion of a class of people, deceased people, to which my grandfather belonged. And when my mother referred to one of them, always invoked this Oliver Shalom. I took this invocation to be pious and respectful. Alev HaSholem means peace be upon him. But to me, Oliver Shalom was a good guy, kind of like God or Santa Claus, who watched over the dead. The opposite of Oliver Shalom was Kinahora. Kina, a female deity, looked after the living. Mother never mentioned a piece of good news about someone without invoking Kinahora. Your brother made the dean's list, Kinahora. Your cousin Sarah, Kinahora, is getting married. I realized in the fullness of time that Kinahora was pronounced post-positively to ward off bad luck. I realized that I should be very, very careful about mentioning anyone's happiness or success because forces out there were eager to destroy it whenever their attention was drawn to it. But not until recently did I understand the exact words and their translation. Kainayin Horda, may there be no evil eye. A startlingly primitive phrase I find more reminiscent of blue Turkish amulets than Talmudic scholarship. Another Yiddish misunderstanding may just have wrecked my religious instinct. Shmai means to stroll or to window shop. For mother, it was a sport like skiing or skating. Let's go shmaying in Cedarhurst meant Let's go checking out the different stores, seeing what's in style or on sale, and maybe stopping for an ice cream soda. Schmying was freestyle shopping, the higher shopping, not materialistic, but a way of exploring the good things of the culture and the life of the city. Everyone in my family pronounced the Shema, the holy Hebrew words for hero Israel, as Shema Yisrael, and I don't think we saw anything strange about a sacred invocation of shopping. My aesthetic vocabulary has been greatly enriched by a word of my mother's, which I have never heard another person use, angapachket. As mother pronounced it, the word sounded like angapachki. She would often enjoin me to go pachki around outside when she was busy in the house or to pachki in the sand at the beach. It meant aimless play, and the judgmental version, stop pachkiing around, could refer to anything from my making crayon marks on a tablecloth to dating a guy she thought was a pisher. The root pachki means make a mess or smear, and angapachki, whose dictionary definition is slapped together or messed up, denoted in my mother's mouth too many styles in one hole, unharmonious in effect. An outfit that I thought gorgeous because it contained all currently fashionable motifs, like a felt skirt with an appliqué poodle studded in sequins, worn with a sweater trimmed in fuzzy angora, might be angapachki, and rightly so, to my mother. To me, no other word now so well expresses the absence of a coherent style in a work of art. The words my mother did not use are as interesting to me as the ones she did. Although feh, meaning yuck, is at the heart of many a Yiddish vocabulary, I never once heard my mother use it. I imagine she would have thought it vulgar or lower class. I think phi was her fe. Another Yiddish word you will see in glossaries, which my mother never used, was balabusta, or excellent housewife. Perhaps she had no interest in the concept. She may have been trapped in a balabusta's body and life, but in her heart she was a yeshiva bacha, someone who would have liked to spend all day reading and often contrived to. And although many people I know use the word verklempt proudly to mean they are all choked up with emotion, often accompanying the word with a hand on the throat, I never once heard my mother use it, possibly because she had no use for people who were frequently verklempt and never aspired to that position herself. A child verklempt risked being mocked as a real Sarah Bernhardt. My mother rarely approved of me. I had a tuchus and a half, a big backside as a child, and as a grown woman, a closet full of shmatas, rags. She called me for shlugana and even for shtunkana. I was a vans, a bedbug, and a pisher. Nachas, which Jewish parents are supposed to be so full of for their children, was not a word she used. I was always nudging her. I was a nudnik. I was a pain in the kishka. I gnashed too much and was always hocking her chinik. Still, however irritated she was at me, I was never a starker, never a chazer, never a ganif, never a schnorrer. By definition, I was not a shiksa or a schwarza. I was too young to be a yenta, too self-absorbed to be a kachleffel, busybody, too restrained to be a schmeichler, flatterer. Nor did she think I was quite a mieskite, ugly, though I was no Miss America. Other children's mothers kfeled over their achievements, but kfel was also not in her vocabulary. Once or twice, good news was greeted by, I'm plotzing with joy, exploding. Even if she was more likely to plots from fatigue, as in, I'm ready to plots, I'm so tired. knew, I think she was fond of me, but Kinahora, one shouldn't speak of one's pleasures, only kvetch about the tsuris, the trouble. The worst kind of tsuris was gahakta tsuris, chopped trouble, utter misery. That for schlugging a girl got pregnant, and her fakakta parents kicked her out, gahakta tsuris. Naturally, I wasn't the only brunt of my mother's Yiddish critiques and rebukes. My father got lots of them, especially about eating. Eli, enough already, stop fressing. Fressing was a manner of eating less benign than noshing. Fressing was eating like an animal, stuffing yourself. And speaking of stuffing, the word for which is stupping, also used for fucking, that was never discussed before the children. However, my mother used stup in the sense of to give or to stuff in the pocket of someone, as in telling my father to stup Phyllis $10 for the parking when I visited them, or stup the bellboy something. Kibitz, tuchis, tushi, shluk, bubkis, bubala, chazarai, kishka, yardside, shidik, mishigas, megillah, shmuz, simitz, oigewalt, oive, veizmir, gutnu. These foreign phonemes were the music of my childhood as much as the Andrews sisters and the Pretenders' songs. My parents belonged to that generation of American Jews, young adults at the time of World War II, who were profoundly uncomfortable with anything German. By the time I was three, the Germans had killed a majority of the 10 million people who had spoken Yiddish in Europe a decade before. Although my parents took advantage of post-war prices to be tourists all over the world, they never went to Germany. And while they were alive, I never did either, not wanting to upset them. But when they were both gone, I visited Berlin and was shocked to feel at home. I heard people say to one another in the street, "Sei gesund," be well, as my mother said to my father when he left for work in the morning, and Gesundheit when someone sneezed. It was at once comforting and unsettling to find haven where you least expected it, to find after a lifetime trying to master French, Italian, and Spanish, in this of all countries, how much I wished I'd mastered my mother's Yiddish. Quickly, I remembered that my mother herself had majored in classics at Hunter College, and I imagine she ended up feeling the same way about Latin and Greek. "Abi gesund," she would say, "as long as you're healthy," implying nothing else matters. If she had a philosophy, that was it. A frail reed to me when I was young, but deeper and deeper in meaning the older I get.